Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the April edition of Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is called The Politeness Project. A stressed-out, straight-talking mom takes the ultimate manners challenge and spends a week being nice to everyone she meets. Recently, three people were rude to me in as many hours. First, a bank teller shrugged and snapped her gum when I asked why she put a hold on my paycheck. Then a teenager boy whizzed by on a skateboard and nearly knocked me flat. Finally, at lunch, the waitress forgot my order. After I reminded her, she brought me cold soup and shoved it in front of me without a word. I'm no doormat, so naturally, I let these people have it. But when I saw the rude waitress stomp into the kitchen to tear into the cook, I instantly regretted my bad temper. She'd been dissed by me, and now she was setting out to do the same thing to someone else. I thought of my British grandmother, who knew how to pour a proper tea and schooled me in the power of good manners early on. When faced with a rude sales clerk, for instance, grandmother was apt to pat the woman's arm, compliment her sweater, and apologize for bothering her, which inevitably led the sales clerk to scurry off to find whatever item my grandmother required, pronto. Grandmother would never have gone off on a waitress the way I did. Instead, she would sweetly ask her to reheat her soup because it was so delicious that she wanted to savor every sip. You catch more flies with honey than vinegar, grandmother always said. As I listened to the muffling shouting coming from the restaurant kitchen, I wondered if it was really true. I would try it, I decided. For one full week, I would make a point of remembering my manners, especially with people who seemed determined to make me forget them. I would attempt to disarm with charm and see if my suddenly improved attitude would have any effect. Day one, I do not go postal. I never went to our local post office. It always had long lines, and to make matter worse, there's a belligerent clerk who works there. Sure enough, while I'm waiting, I overhear her barking at a customer. Then it's my turn. I gather my courage and step up to the counter. "Hi," I say in my most pleasant voice. "How are you?" She scowls. Clearly, I've already overstepped her boundaries. I persist in my politeness experiment, scanning the dog photos taped to the wall beside her. "Is that your dog?" I asked, as I ask sweetly as she weighs my package. To my surprise, the clerk tells me her dog is a Hurricane Katrina rescue. He had to have surgery to repair his hip, but he's doing great now, she says. And then the real shocker, she breaks into a smile. The transformation is amazing, and all it took was one polite question that acknowledged her as an individual. Score one for grandmother's advice. The afterglow of this first encounter lingers on until I'm driving home and a driver cuts me off at the intersection. Experiment forgotten. I honk my horn. Day two. I rethink the angry rant. I'm running errands downtown when I notice that the car is making a sound like a spatula slapping a counter. I get out, look at the flat tire, sigh, and drive to the nearest gas station. The mechanic says he'll fix it in an hour. When I call back an hour later, the mechanic admits that he hasn't touched my car because he's been swamped all morning. I feel my blood start to boil. I should have called AAA, I think, instead of trusting this idiot. I could have arranged for someone else to pick up my son for school if I had known it was going to take this long. I'm about to launch into a rant when I take a deep breath and change tactics. "I'm sorry you're having a crazy day," I tell the mechanic. "I hate to rush you. I'll apologize. It's fine, really. I can call around and get a friend to pick up my son from school. When do you think I might be able to get the car?" There's a brief silence. Then he says he'll put my car on the lift right away. "I'll have it done in 20 minutes, he says. I'm sorry you had to wait. He hangs up. I sit and study my cell phone, stunned. Was this an accident, or are good manners contagious? Day 3. I swallow my road rage. It's the end of a long day, and I have one more step to make at the dry cleaner. This requires a left turn across oncoming traffic, which is backed up from the stoplight, as it always is, and drivers and idling cars are blocking the entrance to the lot where I need to park. I don't blow my horn, though. I just sit there. And then a funny thing happens. First, a driver pulls up to leave almost enough room for me to enter the parking lot. After that, not just one, but two drivers back up so I can make my left turn. And all of them are smiling. I smile and wave, and they wave back. Is this manners karma or what? Day 4. I cough up a kind word. At a meeting, a surly colleague is clearly upset that nobody read his report. I apologize profusely for not getting it done and tell him that I know how frustrated he must feel. The man visibly melts. After the meeting, he explains how hard he worked on the report and confesses that he doesn't think he's a good writer. He tells me that he's worried that maybe that's why nobody reads his stuff, even though writing for a living has been his dream. He looks slightly shy and adds, "I write poetry." Suddenly, I can see this man for who he really is, a wannabe poet. And the truth is, his reports are chock full of important information, even if they are a little dull. My heart goes out to him, and I try to think what might help. Without your reports, nobody would know what's going on, I tell him. They're important. It's just too bad that we're all overwhelmed. He agrees. By the end, we're shaking hands. Keep writing your poetry, I add. He brightens. Thanks. I watch him walk away, wondering about all the other secret lives around me that a little politeness brings into view. Day 5. I don't tell off a telemarketer. A solicitor for a charity calls as our family sits down to eat dinner. Generally, I bark back at these people to take us off their call list, and I slam down the receiver before they can even start to reply. But this night, I say, "Thank you for doing the hard work of raising money for a good cause." The caller falls silent. She thinks I'm yanking her chain. I keep talking. I'd like to contribute, but right now I have 4 kids in college. If I can make the next tuition payment, I promise you that you'll be in the first line for a donation. I really do appreciate your efforts. The caller sputters, then says, "Oh, well, thank you. Have a good night." "You too," I say. The conversation only took 30 seconds longer than my usual hang-up, but I went back to the family dinner feeling all zen instead of irritated. Day 6, I get an A for appreciation. I enter a store where I have to return something without a receipt. The clerk is standing beneath a sign that reads, "No receipt, no return." I notice her necklace as I approach. She raises her hand and touches it, noticing me, noticing it. The necklace is a Celtic cross with silver twigs around it. "I love that necklace," I comment as I approach the counter. Then I tell her about my dilemma. "I'm afraid I bought these pants without trying them on, and it turns out they don't work. Could I please exchange them?" When she smiles and says yes, I make another note to self. People really do warm to them when you notice them and appreciate their efforts, whether they're changing attire or wearing something special. As I leave the store, I feel surprisingly serene. Being mannerly may be the right thing to do, but it's also a surefire way to feel better about yourself. I never realized how horrible I felt about being rude until I stopped. Day 7. I make 2 new friends. On the last day of my experiment, I head out to my local coffee house. This Starbucks is a battleground. Virtual office workers with laptops constantly vie for the best tables. They set up like squatters, buying office space for a price of a latte. I know this because I'm one of them. I score a much coveted piece of real estate, a central table away from the chilly door. I spread out my papers and sip my tea, happy and warm. Then 2 women loaded down with shopping bags come in and search the place. There are no tables left, just the counter. And I wonder, is it good manners to offer them my seat, even if they're just shopping and I'm really working? I ponder this for a split second, or would that be a selfless act that I would soon resent? The only way to find out is to do it. Why don't you take my table, and I'll move to the counter, I say. The women are startled. They protest, uncertain, casting their eyes around the room for another option. There isn't any. Finally, they give in. I move to the counter, which, as I suspect, is too narrow to work on, though I manage. 10 minutes later, someone gently taps me on the shoulder. It's one of the women. The other one has snagged the only free window table and is holding it for me. We thought you should have it because you're so nice, they say, and we're all smiling. Living the dream, make it happen. Here is one lady's goal and how she reached it. Her goal? To be a clown. She is Laurie McAlulup. That's a hard name. From Auburn, New York, age 45. How I did it. My mother lived for years with a form of leukemia. In 2006, her health worsened, and it struck me how fleeting life was. I began to reevaluate what I was doing and what I wanted to do. I made a list of goals, and at the top was going to clown school, something I always thought about. My parents used to take my siblings and me to see the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, and the clowns were my favorite part. They still are. When I graduated from college, I toyed with enrolling in clown school, but I wasn't really ready to take a risk. After my mother became really ill, though, I thought, this is my moment. I researched clown schools and signed up for a week-long program in New York's Goofs, a clown school in New York City. We focused on skills like applying makeup, juggling, and balancing. I can now balance a folding chair on my chin. And I've learned to develop characters. I created Lulu Lollipop. The name is from Lou, my childhood nickname. A week later, I found out my already sick mother had developed lung cancer, which would eventually take her life. When I went to visit her in the hospital, she was sitting in a room filled with sad and scared people getting chemo. Before I walked in, I took my red clown nose out of my backpack and put it on. Everyone burst out laughing. My mom was laughing and crying at the same time. I decided right then and there that I wanted to volunteer as a hospital clown. I began to offer my services at local hospitals, children's organizations, and charity events. Word spread, and now I appear as Lulu about twice a month. So often when someone enters a child's hospital room, it's to poke or prod or to run tests or ask questions. I want to bring a few moments of laughter and relief to kids and their families. I give kids a chance to be silly and let their imagination soar. I teach them magic tricks and take them for a few moments to a happier place. What I learned? Laughter really does have healing powers. I'm reminded of this every time I visit a kid in the hospital and a parent says, "This is the first time he smiled since he got here." Hospital clowning has a spiritual aspect to it, too. When you deal so closely with sickness and death, you assess what's important. You learn not to dwell on the past or worry about the future. You're forced into the present. I want to encourage people to enjoy every moment, especially the one when a clown walks into the room and pulls out a rubber chicken. Now for the answer lady. Questions and answers on manners and morals. Here's our first question. I'm throwing myself a 40th birthday party, and I'd like to invite a few work friends. However, there are only about a dozen people on staff, and I'm worried the rest of my coworkers will feel left out. What should I do? Here's the answer. In a situation like this, you're better off putting all or none of your coworkers on the guest list. The only other option, inviting only the people you're closest to and asking them to keep the party a secret. That's a bad idea. The excluded people will probably find out about the party somehow and may feel hurt. If you have enough space and can afford to do so, why not invite everyone? I'm sure your coworkers will appreciate the kind gesture. And chances are, only a few of them will show up anyway. Next question. I recently emailed my cousin to complain about my sister-in-law. It turns out that I accidentally sent the email to my sister-in-law. She's barely speaking to me now. What should I do? Darn that light, quick send button. It's amazing how much family drama one little tap of the finger can cause. To get back on good terms with your sister-in-law, write her a note and apologize profusely. Since she's given you the silent treatment, you may not have much luck getting her on the phone. Say something like, I'm so happy that you're part of our family. This is why I am hoping you can forgive me for sending that email. It was rude and an immature thing for me to do. If I had something to say, I should have come to you. Then tell you how much I value your relationship. It probably won't be an instant fix, but it may lead to a gradual thaw. And I'm sure I don't need to tell you to double or even triple check the addresses in your to line before you send emails from now on. Our last question. My friend lost her mom to cancer last year, and she's very depressed about it. I want to suggest that she get counseling, but I'm not sure how to say it when she's this fragile. Here's the answer. Even though it's not unusual to mourn a loved one for a year or more, a counselor or support group could help her work through the pain. However, she might just want permission to talk about her feelings with you. People who are coping with a loss like this may worry that their friends will get tired of listening to them, so they keep their emotions bottled up. So invite her over for coffee one day and ask her if she still feels sad and how she's coping. Wait until later in the conversation to casually say, have you thought about joining a support group or something like that? If you don't think she can afford individual counseling, you might mention that hospice, hospitals, and churches offer sponsor bereavement groups. Just keep in mind that sometimes there's no way to speed the healing process. If you can accept that it takes a long time, then you're a true friend. Never underestimate the power of a woman. Sweet dreams. Needy children are sleeping a little better thanks to one woman's creative clothing drive. During her former life as an elementary school teacher in a low-income school district in Bowling, Texas, Emily Gertson often worried about the underprivileged children in her class. The ones who never had enough to eat, wore the same outfit days in a row, and didn't have their own school supplies. Although Gertson left teaching in 2006 to be a stay-at-home mom, those students still weighed on her mind. 6 months later, after watching a TV show about women who collected clothing for at-risk and foster children, she was inspired to take action. I learned that these kids are often removed from their homes with just the clothes on their backs, Gertson said. I wanted to give them something that would help them feel more comfortable and less scared, and new pajamas seemed like a good place to start. Gertson decided to hold a pajama drive to benefit her local Child Protection Services, which investigates child neglect and abuse claims and offers foster care and adoptions. She spread the word by calling and emailing friends, church members, and a local Cub Scout troop. More than 100 pairs of pajamas soon appeared. Gertson then planned a second event with the help of a neighbor, Shelley DeLuna. By the end of the six-week drive, they had collected a whopping 1,500 pairs of new pajamas, plus diapers, shampoo, soap, and toys. The drives were such a success that Gertson and DeLuna have now expanded their mission to include backpacks, sneakers, and school supplies. The new PJs did more than just make the kids' night a little cozier when they realized they get to keep them. The children were surprised and happy, said Gertson. The Child Protection Services Office told me that some of these kids have never owned anything new in their lives. So this month's challenge, three ways to make the days a little brighter for disadvantaged children. 1. Collect suitcases, bags, and backpacks and donate them to your local child protective agency. Many foster kids carry their few belongings in trash bags. 2. Walk to Raise Money for Foster Care Associations. The organization Walk Me Home hosts 5K events nationwide. Visit walkmehome.org to find out about a walk near you. 3. Mentor or tutor a child who has been placed in foster care. You can do it virtually through online programs, and that would be at casey.org/get involved. Best friends. One amazing German Shepherd has changed the lives of a family with two autistic kids. My 5-year-old son Matthew is a little Houdini, says Sharon Lindsay, a single stay-at-home mom from Illinois. He can undo any lock and get outside if you take your eyes off of him for a minute. He's actually gone missing on several occasions. Because he has autism, he has no sense of danger, Lindsay explains. It's a huge worry, since we live by a busy street. And until recently, Matthew's 9-year-old sister, Lauren, who is also autistic, had the opposite problem. She was terrified of strangers and refused to leave the house, even to play in her own backyard. Then 2 years ago, the family got Brock, an autism service dog, and life improved dramatically. Matthew used to have up to 25 tantrums a day and would get so upset that he'd bang his head against a wall or pull out his own hair. But Brock is trained to watch for signs of a meltdown. If the kids are crying or distressed, Brock will gently nuzzle them until they calm down, Lindsay says. Now Matthew is down to 3 or 4 milder outbursts a week. Brock has done wonders for Lauren, too, helping her feel confident enough to go to birthday parties and even summer camp. The kids think she's cool because she's allowed to bring a dog to activities like reading night. When the family went shopping, Matthew used to wander away, and Lauren would panic at the sight of strangers. Now Matthew is safe in public, tethered to Brock with a special harness, and Lauren is more relaxed. She calls Brock her protector. The changes in both of them are amazing, Lindsay marvels. They're different kids. Although doctors predicted Matthew would never speak, these days he's talking in complete sentences and reading at a first grade level. Lindsay feels that Brock calms him down enough so he can learn better. One of Matthew's first full sentences was directed to Brock. I love you. Last winter, Matthew slipped out of the house again while Lindsay was taking a shower. Brock, who is trained in search and rescue, helped her find him 2 blocks away. Lindsay was overjoyed and relieved. It's so wonderful to have Brock because he's on duty 24/7. Here's 3 other clever canines who found their callings. Do good dogs. Leo, one of the pit bulls rescued from Michael Vick's dog fighting operation, was trained for battle. Then he was adopted by Marthina McClay, founder of Our Pack, a rescue organization in Los Gatos, California. McClay could see that he had a softer side. Now Leo's a therapy dog who comforts cancer patients in health clinics. It takes your mind off your illness, said Ruth Adams from California, who is in remission from leukemia. He's a survivor, just like me. Ricochet. Ricochet was raised to be a service dog, but when she began chasing birds, she had to be retired. I still wanted her to do something meaningful, says her owner Judy Friduno. So, just for fun, the San Diego native taught the dog to surf. And now, Rip Curl Ricky rides waves to raise money for local charities. Nearly $18,000 so far. What's more, a video about her went on YouTube. I wanted her to help just one person, Fredino said. Instead, she's touched thousands of lives. Our last dog is Sela. Sela started life as a pet who was trained to compete in frisbee competitions. But surprisingly, her greatest gift lay elsewhere. Sela was almost 2 when her owner, Teresa, who had epilepsy, discovered that the Aussie mix could predict seizures. Now with Sela by her side, the veterinary technician from Georgia can live worry-free. Even better, Brantley's having fewer episodes. Knowing CeeLo will warn me hours in advance really cuts my stress level. It's a huge load off my mind. A volunteer nation. In these troubled economic times, more and more American women are reaching out to help others in need. Meet these Lady Home Journal readers who are doing community service for the first time this year. Lisa Anderson of Newport Beach, California. She is mentoring prisoners' kids. What I do, I spend about 2 hours a week with an 11-year-old girl whose father is in jail. We go to the beach, hit the zoo, get manicures, or see a movie. Sometimes we just hang out. She really loves to eat and play hangman. Why I do it? Over the years, I've gone to fundraisers for various charities, but I wanted to do more than just go to fancy dinners and balls. I decided it was time to do something hands-on. I signed up for this mentoring program and promised that I'd work with this girl for a year. But I've already decided to stick with it. I want to be involved in her life as long as I can. An unexpected challenge? It can be hard to get in touch with her. Her mother is on government assistance, lives in a high crime area, and doesn't have a phone. Several times I had to get other volunteers to help me find her. But kids need consistency, so I make sure we get together. I want her to know that she's important to me. The personal payoff? My own father has been out in and out of prison for 25 years. Even though I was an adult when this happened, it was still devastating. Before I started volunteering, I was too embarrassed to talk about it. But once I started telling my new pal that she is not her father, I realized it was true for me too. Our next volunteer is helping homeless teens. Her name is Eulalia of Atlanta, Georgia. What I do? I'm involved with a program that provides assistance for kids who are living on the streets. I walk around at night looking for young people who are sleeping in parks, passageways, or bus depots, and I try to make sure they get the services they need. Why I do it? I was laid off last year and needed something to keep me busy while I job hunted. As a new mom, I felt strongly about doing something to help kids. My friend is involved in this program and loves it, so I decided to try it. A night's work. I go up to the kids and ask them, "How can I make your life better tonight?" Their answers are always different. Maybe they need a hot shower, a safe place to sleep, or a healthy meal. We're trying to get them what they need. Sometimes these kids just need someone to talk to. They've got lots of problems. Some are addicted to drugs. Others are fleeing abusive homes. We meet their immediate needs first, but ultimately our goal is to get them off the streets. Greatest insight? I'm unemployed and I'm the mother of a toddler. You might think that's enough stress in my own life, so why add more? But volunteering has actually made my life less stressful. It helps me realize that I am much better off than I thought. My budget may be tight, but I can always go to the refrigerator and find something to eat. Many of these kids can't do that. These days, I count my blessings. Our next volunteer is Gail from Texas. What I do? For 3 hours every week, I tutor adults who read on a second grade to sixth grade level. We use books, magazines, and websites to teach them. Why I do it? A friend once told me that she thinks that education charities are most effective because they break the cycle of poverty. So I decided this year that I was ready to do something. I went online and found volunteermatch.org. I keyed info like my hometown, women, and education. It was a perfect fit. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.